I think we're at 9 o'clock, actually a couple minutes after. So welcome. It's good to have you here. We've got some new faces. So we're just going to continue our little liturgy, if you will, our ordo that we've been using the last couple of days, where we reframe the days that we have been, which I think whether or not you've been on the journey all along, I still think it's helpful to kind of go back and kind of talk about where we've been. So this concept, broken table, came from an experiment in my backyard, and actually today I'll be sharing a specific story from that experiment with us. But it was an attempt to gather people who maybe left church because it just wasn't a fit for them, people who had never been to church, had tried it, but it kind of felt like a foreign culture. I had Buddhists and Unitarians and agnostics and pagans and all kinds of people sitting in my backyard. And we were trying to, well, we had food together, which was lovely. And we were trying to have conversation about what does community look like. And really not just community, but specifically one where you can talk about faith and belief and sort of this larger idea of meaning. So the concept of broken table, it was sort of twofold. One, I think the sort of gathering places that we have used as Christian peoples, if you will, are breaking. They're sort of coming undone. Some are functioning in quite healthy ways, and I do want to honor that. I've had a couple of people talk to me, and they're like, but my church. and I know there's some lovely things happening where people are really reaching out to the community around them. But I think as a whole, a lot of the, what I would argue is a lot of the cultural ways that we have normalized just doesn't connect. It doesn't speak to much of today's culture. So my first point is that I believe that our tables, our gathering ways, are ready to be upturned, to be broken open, so that they actually are a welcoming place for the broken, right? We need to find new directions together. So that was kind of the first point that we went into. Because if you're setting on a journey, you really need to set an intention. And I talked a little bit about even my husband's and my coming to Holden Village. When we were in conversation with the directors, they said, do you have kind of a moment, right, where you knew that this was kind of where you were supposed to be coming? And both of us went, yeah, that's true. And we could remember the conversations and where we were sitting and some of the different things that happened. They said, good, you'll need that because there'll be time probably about mid-year where you'll wonder why the heck you're here. And it's same true if you're going on a journey, especially one where you're intentionally going into the unknown and trying to welcome new wisdom, stuff that's just totally different from your life background. You need that intention to kind of hold fast to. So that was our first day, and mine is to intentionally welcome conversation with a variety of people and listen. So point two, as we head out in new directions for the sake of connecting better with the fullness of our communities, the people we are needing to connect with, and I want to be real clear with this, are not done with belief, right? I mean, we sort of think, oh, they're all atheists, you know? And I think even people that would call themselves atheists are not necessarily done with belief. They're done with organized, institutionalized religion. And what I was most surprised by was that they're not wanting to be left to go it alone. Because I just figured if institutions and communities in the name of faith and Christian gathering spaces have been so broken that they would just kind of want it to go alone, but that's not what I found. People really, I think it's part of who we are as human beings, welcome, that we long to have a community to gather together. And so we were looking at that on Tuesday as we decide what kinds of things could facilitate that coming together. Like, what kinds of things would you want to pack with you? And just to be clear, I feel like I just need to say this over and over again, because you know, there's a we that's still sort of here trying to gather and be this Christian people, and there's a them that have stopped coming to these gatherings. We can get into this dualistic mind, which is why I spent some time with Richard Rohr on Tuesday to enter into more of a non-dual, so we're not putting people in compartments, because I really believe that there is no them, only us. I believe that the church is actually starving, if not significantly malnutritioned, because part of our body is not here. And again, my apology for that being a mixed metaphor, but that's what I'm rolling with anyway. And then finally, point three, I guess, is that as a Christian people, we gather around Christ saying that he is the way, right? But what if Jesus' way is not actually a fixed path? What if Jesus' way is a manner of doing things or even a movement? Like the original followers of Jesus were known as followers of the way. It was a way of being with each other, with Jesus at the center, less of a fixed path. So instead of a well-trod path, I believe we need a compass so that we can go on different adventures and then come back together to celebrate what we have learned. Okay. So a lot of that was covered in day one, but really came out as we've been together. On day two, we talked about, you know, what to pack, and I think we settled in on some things like curiosity and love, being intentional. Again, living out, if you're going to pack, you know, if you're setting this intention, make sure you've got that at the ready as you think about what you're carrying with you into your pilgrimage. And somebody pointed out that intention is actually the two words in tension, and to be okay with that, that's part of us living into the comfort, but also being very clear that along the journey, people need places of safety, right? And especially if you're encountering one who is different from you, it's natural for us to have sort of an insecurity or a fear. And so even though we are intentionally going out into the unknown, in the midst of that, we have to figure out how to create safe spaces for one another. So yesterday, we focused on how we enter the unknown and what kinds of things are helpful. We talked a lot about blindness. Being blindsided, going into a situation blindly, perhaps experiencing actual blindness. Because truly, if you are entering into some of these unknown territories, there will be times when we feel unprepared and blindsided. And because there was a lot of conversation on Tuesday, like, well, what do we pack? Because I need to know where we're going. Well, the thing about pilgrimage and sort of this imagined course that we're taking the church on is that we don't know where we're going. It's a time of experimentation, I believe, in Christian communities, and we need to take some risks, and some things are going to work, and some things aren't. And we can't drag the whole church history with us. We talked about finding what was meaningful in our past and thinking about what we need for the future and looking where they overlap and discarding the rest, right? Even though there were meaningful things that gave life in the past, if they're not overlapping with the needs of the future, perhaps it's time to not put them in our pack, but to set them aside, to give them away, to leave them in storage. Maybe tell stories about them from time to time, right? So what are the kernels that we really need to carry with us? So I really wanted us to live into some of those emotions of it yesterday. And if you only dwell in kind of like the, oh, this is, you know, where I've been, you know, that's not unhealthy. If you just jump to the new experience, right, as you encounter the unknown and you just throw yourself into that, you kind of lose yourself. So how do you hold both of these, both past and present together, and future present together? How do you hold those things together where they can kind of inform one another? And we can come together as whole people. So, that, to the best of my ability, is a summary. Is there any reflections as you left this place yesterday that you kind of want to comment on, or questions or comments on this brief introduction? One of my favorite parts of these times together is the dialogue that you all have been bringing. But we may be ready to jump into day four, which is welcoming new wisdom. Okay, Well, I think, as you recall, on Monday, I'm not sure we ever got to the reflected text that I had planned to live into. Tuesday, we got to it at the very end. Wednesday, we hit it about the middle. And today, we're going to jump into the Living Word text first off. So does everybody have this section of Ephesians? So the verse numbers are there, but by way of transparency, please note that I've eliminated some sections of chapter 4. Just I feel like I need to say that out loud. All right, so a little bit about Ephesians. Like Eugene Peterson, this Practice Resurrection book is a commentary on the book of Ephesians, and I've been preaching from Ephesians primarily this summer as it has been part of our lectionary, and I just thought there were some good nuggets that I wanted to share with you all today specifically in this welcoming of new wisdom. And as Eugene Peterson kind of walks you through the book of Ephesians, it's important to note that the first half of Ephesians is kind of how we think about God, our understanding of God. And then at the beginning of chapter 4, which we have here is sort of this hinge into the second half of Ephesians, whereas if this is what we believe about God and who Jesus Christ is, the second half is, so now what? You know, how do we live as a people? And so that is what chapter 4 is now starting to delve into. So we kind of have that frame. I would love to have your voices read some of this out loud. So again, as this text is read, there's three paragraphs there, and so I'll invite three different people to read those sections. And then as you listen to the text read, you know, we will dig into understanding, but I really want kind of your first reactions in this first reading. So just kind of let rise to the top, you know, and don't judge it. Just be like, wow, this is what stuck out to me. And then I'm going to invite you to talk in groups of twos and threes after we get through the text once, just to kind of process, well, yeah, this is what stuck out to me, and to wonder together why it was that that rose to the top, and then listen to what rose to the top for others, okay? So do I have somebody that would read that first paragraph? I think it's verses 1 through 6. Wonderful. Somebody that would read 11 through... I need my reading glasses, 16. So the second paragraph, great, thanks, Mike. And then the last one, maybe a female voice, wonderful. Okay, great. So.
I therefore, the prisoner in the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, making every effort to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in all. But each of us was given grace according to the measure of Christ's gift.
The gifts he gave were that some would be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, to equip the saints for the work of the ministry, for building up the body of Christ, until all of us come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to maturity, to the measure of the full stature of Christ. We must no longer be children, tossed to and fro and blown about by every wind of doctrine, by people's trickery, by their craftiness and deceitful scheming, but speaking the truth in love. We must grow up in every way into Him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by every ligament with which it is equipped, as each part is working properly, promotes the body's growth in building itself up in love.
So then, putting away falsehood, let all of us speak the truth to our neighbors, for we are members of one another. Be angry, but do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and do not make room for the devil. Thieves must give up stealing. Rather, let them labor and work honestly with their hands, so as to have something to share with the needy. Let no evil talk come out of your mouths, but only what is useful for building up, as there is need, so that your words may give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, with which you were marked with a seal for the day of redemption. Put away from you all bitterness and wrath and anger and wrangling and slander, together with all malice, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ has forgiven you.
Now, normally in this kind of entering into scripture, this is way more text than I would normally give to you. But I'm trying to cover a fair amount of territory, short amount of time, so please don't feel like you need to take it all in. I'm going to walk you through some of this too. But right now, with the people sitting around you, feel free, you don't have to summarize the text or come to any conclusions. I want you just to kind of raise up a couple pieces that stood out to you. And again, I invite you to kind of look around and make sure that everybody is welcomed into a conversation. So you can have about 5 to 10 minutes. We'll see how it goes.
You can.
We need to grow
up. All right.
So to me, those.
I'm curious to hear.
Tied together.
What you have noticed. And again, remember this is a letter, right, that Paul was writing to the churches in Ephesus. And this is him trying to say, okay, so we've now walked through what it is that we believe about God and who Jesus Christ is. Now I want to start talking to you about how you're going to embody that, right? How you're going to live that out. So what kind of person are we to be as we go along this pilgrimage? What themes? And feel free to highlight something that somebody else in the group said that you thought was wise. So, I mean, you can speak something that you noticed, but also feel comfortable sharing what somebody else said, because I think that today we're looking at how do we welcome new wisdom, right? And so a lot of times we're afraid to speak. And so even I think it's good to sort of claim, name the wisdom of somebody else and say, I really love this. So, yeah.
In the first paragraph, in our tiny little group, we had one person celebrating the inclusivity of one faith, one baptism, and another person who said, this is a very exclusive paragraph.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting here going, oh my gosh, yes. Both and,
you betcha.
And I want to spend 2 more days on that. Just to try to wrestle with that.
Yeah. But
we hear the same thing and come to 2 different things.
Yes.
I love it.
And it happens more than you know. Because,
yeah.
I mean, think of the number of times. I'll just tell you a quick little story. I was working with missionaries briefly in Peru. And this was kind of on the border of Bolivia and the Altiplano, and there's these beautiful mountains kind of there on the ridge, and on the top there was a cross. I thought, oh, how lovely. You know, it's a Catholic, you know, the settled from Spain and whatever and all the baggage that brings. But, you know, there's a cross on the mountain, and I thought, oh, wow, it's amazing. And then there was like even like the next hill over there was this white Jesus and so but anyway we saw the cross on the mountain. We're like, okay. And the missionary said, yeah, that actually has nothing to do with Jesus. And we said, what? And they said, yeah, no, the animistic belief system here, the mountain god, that's the symbol for the mountain god. So that's why it's up there. And I'm like, oh, but yeah, but Jesus is on the next mountain over. And they're like, yeah, when the Catholics were trying to build the Jesus statue, it hailed and rained and it was like terrible storms. And the construction workers finally stopped and they said they needed to make an offering to the mountain god represented by the cross in order to feel safe in building the Jesus statue on the mountain god's mountain. Okay, so I mean, even like a cross, we can't claim for ourselves in Incan religion. I should have worn it today, a medallion that looks like a cross, but it's actually the representative of their own religious system of sort of, you know, ground, which is like serpent, and then land, which is their cougar, and then the heavens, which is their condor. So, and it looks Trinitarian, it's great. And I wear that to remember this, that you can read exactly the same text and have totally different conclusions, and we're not even prepared for it a lot of the time. So thank you. Yeah.
What else? I think that speaks to the last line in there. Each of us was given grace according to the measure of Christ's gifts. Each of us has a different gift, a different interpretation, a different way of experiencing.
Pack that in your pack.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else? Anything else? Because,
we focus on our differences.
Mm-hmm.
Of who we are and what we bring to the table. And then we focus on how frustrated we are with anger and nastiness in the world. How can we deal with
it? Yeah. So I want to ask, because I mean, Paul digs right into that, right? The meanness and the nastiness. There's a lot of language in here trying to shape how it is that we talk to each other, right? And how it is that we hear each other. Mm-hmm. I just want to ask you, where do you think the meanness and the nastiness comes from?
Being afraid.
What else?
Fear.
Idolatry.
Idolatry? Wait, in what? Idolatry of what?
I am the center of the universe.
Oh, sort of that egocentric idolatry,
yeah.
Yes.
You do not have my truth, you're just nothing.
Yeah, my grandpa used to say, I don't have any opinions, I possess only truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a piece of work. But he gave me $100 when I saw him, so I mean, no, I love my grandpa, but he was a man of another time, to be sure.
So when you jumped off at the word fear, fear of what? I'm curious. Fear of what?
Fear of, okay, I have a belief.
Thank you.
And if I listen to you, it's going to change my thoughts perhaps. And I don't want my thought to be less than for me, I guess.
Isn't that true, though? That I think so many people have this fear that when they hear a different opinion, or a different wisdom, or a different, but that's going to kind of rattle their own belief system.
Interesting. And along that line, I just saw when like one of my sisters was parenting her young daughter and did it differently than my mother. Then my mother took that as a conviction that she had done it wrong.
Oh gosh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't that true? So you have a way of doing something, and then you feel like you've modeled that well for somebody else, and then they choose to do something else. And they may have totally appreciated what you gave them, but they're still choosing, but the other person feels it as an accusation, a conviction of that, a judgment, right? That this is not valuable. Yeah.
In times past, and I think still in practice, this text has been used to say that pastors have the truth and the rest of us do not. And that has set up tension and fear on the part of those of us who do not have the truth.
Right.
And I don't know how we're going to get past that, but it keeps people from expressing because they might have great insight of the Spirit, but afraid they're going to be told they're wrong.
Right. Well, look at the way we've even set this up. And I talked to you about this, I think, on Tuesday. I'm up here, I got my little podium, my little whiteboard, I got a microphone. On Sundays I get to wear a white dress and like the fancy colored stole things and little plastic things in my neck, right? It sets that up. And I've really wondered about, as we move forward and we carry this church forward into pilgrimage, do the pastors need to check some of their, you know, and again, I want to be clear, there's lovely history as to why pastors wear these things, right? I mean, the black, again, is supposed to be a sign of the sin of said leader. The white over is to embrace that even though pastors are sinful, just like everybody else, the white overlay is to say, but we are baptized into Christ and it's supposed to be this lovely. And we stick them on high podiums because in old churches where there wasn't microphone systems that allowed everybody to be able to hear the word of God. All well and good, right? But it's theologically created the sense of this person, and granted their own egos have brought this in too, right? That, you know, there's more that we have to share because, I know, I've been to seminary, la, la, la. But we need to figure that out. I mean, I think one of the things that I would want to leave in storage or to give away is this sort of centralized pastor-centric leadership, and is there a way that we can move forward with a more collaborative model?
But I do think that having, I've always thought of pastors as teachers.
Yep.
You know, so, and teachers encourage, generally, you know, conversation and learning. So I appreciate a pastor. I don't idolize a pastor. And this is just me. But, you know, I'm thinking almost like a facilitator or a teacher. And that's, but you're right, sometimes ego gets in there and then they become, and we do it with them, we start kind of idolizing that leader.
I mean, I have sat with, you know, ladies in the church basement, right? I talked about this a couple days ago a little bit, but, you know, who've been in the church way longer than me. And quite frankly, probably have read their Bibles. I may know some of the background of Bibles more than they do, but I bet you they've read their Bibles more than I have, right? And I think there's a certain presence that they bring to that text that I don't bring. And so when I try to engage them in conversation, you know, these sweet Norwegian ladies are like, oh, but Pastor, I don't know. Oh, yeah.
As an example, I lived in Tucson for a while, went to church there, and was invited to the men's Bible study. Well, I've been to many men's Bible studies. But in this Bible study, pastors were not allowed. Here's what happened. There were, on an average, we met once a week, on the average, there were 25 men that would come.
Yep.
And the way they had it set up, they take the book, we took Ephesians, but we take different books, and each person would read a line.
Mm-hmm.
They became part of that group. They were able to say something, and then we get into discussion. So I appreciate pastors a lot, but sometimes in a Bible study, everybody kind of is pretty silent because they want the pastor to lead the group. This was a wonderful group. I don't live there anymore, but it continues on.
Yeah. I mean, I will even tell you, as a pastor at Holden Village, I think I feel more like a layperson.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, I mean, yeah, I went through seminary, but I don't count myself as an academic, right? Like, I'm not like super smart that remembers all the details. I'm more of like a relational, which I've probably picked up on. But you know what I'm saying? And so even here where there's so many like really super smart people that come here and talk, I'm like, who am I?
Right?
I think a good, in my mind, I think a good pastor or leader, like in the job I do, I facilitate a lot of things with people that know way more than I do about the subject. So I think that's, to me, that's a great pastor that can facilitate and bring that out and, you know, with people's knowledge.
Because what if that realization provoked, rather than fear, of I can't speak because all those people know more than I do and I don't want to look stupid. What if it provoked curiosity and wonder and participation and sort of humble listening? Right? Because one possible title I had for today was Embracing Diversity, which is kind of what I want us to do, right? But this is such a better turn of phrase. Welcoming wisdom. And so I'm going to move forward. Thank you. You know, I'm hoping Jonah can get me the recordings of these because I want to go back and listen to what all of us have been saying together. Because I just deeply appreciate all of you.
I'm just going to say that the line, speaking the truth in love, we must grow up in every way into him. To me, that just really flags came down and everything, because I thought that with all the conflict that we have and the inability to speak to each other in a reasonable manner, mm-hmm. in a respectful and humble manner,
yeah.
is a lot of the problem. And if you speak the truth in love,
yeah.
that seems to give us that more openness, open heart, heart-to-heart type of communication.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the speaking the truth in love, but I think what happens is a lot of times, because we don't know how to do that because we're so angry,
yeah.
right? I mean, I think of the extremes that my dad and I are on politically. Mm-hmm. I spent a week with him, and out of love, we chose not to speak to each other about really anything of substance. Mm-hmm. I felt so vacant by the time I left. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd been near my dad, but I hadn't really been with my dad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think we have to speak truth to each other, mm-hmm. right? Knowing that we are going to disagree with each other and maybe even incense each other, but we still have to figure out how to create a safe space for it. Yeah.
In the days that we are in right now, it seems like, I mean, we're talking here, and the text says that truth and love are really important, like perhaps more important than winning.
What? What country do you live in?
Yeah, in our society, at least here, and I don't know about the rest of the world, what is punished is not winning. And what is held up as an example for what to do is winner take all. And until that changes, I think that the society, the way it's set up, is too powerful for us to really embody this. And I don't know how we change it, but it feels necessary.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me as a Christian, Jesus' death on the cross kind of embodies the steps that we need to take, right? I mean, that he emptied himself of all rights and privileges, and to everyone's perception, looked like he had failed, right? That he didn't win, he lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like something that Diane said when we were talking. If you can affect your area, you know, who are you? Because we can't change the whole world. That's not really mm-hmm. realistic. But if we can affect what's around us, I know that's not exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Basically.
But the operative word there is speaking it in love.
Yeah.
I can receive lots of truth from somebody that I know is not going to try to hurt me. But if I have any sense that they want to do me harm, I can't listen to their truth. And so being able to speak in love, and for me that is total acceptance of the other, whether they agree with me or not. I quit wearing my t-shirt that says, if I agree with you, we're both wrong. Because that's just not a helpful statement to make. So that in love, to me, just becomes the dynamic.
So I'm already reordering. I don't think we're going to get to Robin Wolkemmerer, which breaks my heart, but if you want to talk to me about braiding sweetgrass, I would love to talk, because I wanted to kind of take us on a pilgrimage to a foreign land, perhaps, which is actually right here, Turtle Island, the place that we now call home as migrants, immigrants. Let me ask. I mean, we can delve into that, because I've got plenty I can say about Ephesians. There's a couple nuances that I could quickly try to summarize. Is there a will of the group?
Is braiding sweetgrass about Ephesians?
No.
I'm curious about that.
Yeah. All right, let me see if I can summarize Ephesians. I've actually got a recording of Robin reading her book, and she tells the creation story for her people, the Potawatomi people, and really for a lot of my knowledge of Native peoples to Turtle Island, which is sort of this continent that we now know as United States, Mexico, Canada, my knowledge of that is not broad. My husband actually picked this book as we were preparing to go to Holden, and she is shaping me. I didn't know how hungry I was. She's a scientist and a member of the Potawatomi tribe, and then so she weaves science and her own cultural stories, religious stories, and memoir, and that's just lovely. So maybe we will enter in that, because I really, to welcome new wisdom, I feel like we need to encounter new wisdom. So let me just try and walk you through a little bit, and if we stay over a little bit, is that okay? Mm-hmm. Feel free to get up and go if you need to. Okay. Real quickly about Ephesus, this text was being written, a lot of the letters that were written in the New Testament were addressing a problem. Actually, all of them except Ephesians, and I want you to hear that, because you saw all the language that we read today. Ephesians is a letter addressing a people, but there's actually no problem that needs to be addressed. So this language that Paul is using is for a group that is going along just fine. Thank you very much. These are just some reminders. Ephesus is on the corner of the Aegean Sea, where diversity was a given because people were traveling from all kinds of different places. And so it was a real natural place where politics, economics, religious differences would all be pushing up against each other. And that is where they intentionally decided to set up some of these initial Christian communities, right? These original followers of the way. It wasn't outside the fray of the messiness of diversity, but right in the thick of it. And I want us to hear that. So coming together as a faithful community, that would have been a huge challenge. And so you hear Paul begging us. And this is one of the things, I'm going to use a little bit of Greek here. He talks, there's a word that he uses there, to urge. And this is something that Eugene Peterson pointed out. He said the word urge is, in Greek, is sort of a paraklesis or parakletic, and I'll get into what that means. The other two I think you're going to be more familiar with. There's language that we use as far as activity and how we are with one another in church, and his argument is that we focused on two and not this third one, paraklesis. The first one is kerygma, which is this preaching, which we're very comfortable with, right? I mean, we expect in a church that there's going to be somebody that gets up and is charismatic, that proclaims the gospel, that gets up and, you know, in a emotional sense. And the other one is didactic. That one is probably, we expect there's going to be some teaching, right? That you're going to get some knowledge. And those are really the two that I think we as church have gathered around and kind of packed as high and holy. Like, we want our good preaching and we want our good teaching, right? But there's this third thing that in the church of Ephesians was equally present, and it's sort of been the ignored third part, the sort of paraklesis. And it's hard. The word urge is in there. Encourage would be part of it. Discernment, spiritual direction. It's that relational. You can't do this with me standing up on a microphone, right? Which is why I was very intentional about making sure you had time to sit with each other. This paracletic movement is much more of a relational piece, and the gospel is equally embodied there, right? It's not just out of preaching, it's just not out of teaching, but it is this coming together, this sort of formative discernment, encouraging of one another, that is essential to our embodying who we are as a gathered people, right, in faith. So, so I'm going to skip through some of this stuff. Okay, so this is the other point I wanted to make. So, my argument is that if we're not disagreeing with each other, if we're not finding some difference just by how the church set up in Ephesus, I think we're doing something wrong, right? If there isn't some stuff where we're kind of like, but I have this idea, but I have this idea that's different. If we're all kind of getting along swimmingly, my guess is that we're doing something wrong. Now, Paul warns us in verse 14 to not be like children, right? Who can get tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine, people's trickery and craftiness and scheming, which for too long, I believe, has been interpreted by the church as eliminate messiness, right? Don't get tossed and fro by every wind of doctrine. So let's focus on one doctrine and make sure that we're all stepping in line and we're on the same path, right? Isn't that? I mean, you've heard that text, like, oh, don't be tossed to and fro by people's trickery and craftiness and scheming. But look at what comes right before that warning in verses 11 and 12. Clearly stating that there will be different leadership styles. There will be different gifts, all of which contribute to our being a whole and healthy community. Which leads me to believe that the trickery, the craftiness, the scheming that he's warning us about may have actually been efforts to eliminate some of this diversity. Or to raise up, in dualistic thinking, right, to raise up some leadership gifts, and this is what you're talking about, the pastor thing, to raise up some leadership gifts up to be more important than others. But that's the craftiness and the trickery and the scheming. To be honest, church communities have been doing this forever, from the very beginning. I think it's just part of our human DNA, unfortunately. And then when we disagree with each other, we splinter off into, you know, groups and factions and spin-offs and the no longer affiliated until we are so fractured and our tables are so broken that we don't even feel like a body anymore. Right? So, I mean, my argument, and I'm going to just, we're going to sit with Sky Woman for a little bit, but that we've got to figure out how to speak truth to each other in love. Mm-hmm. And to embrace the diversity and not try and eliminate it. To come to places where we disagree with each other, but we still love each other. And to trust that maybe that was God's intent. That maybe that was God's plan all along. The Tower of Babel story that I told, that so many of us count as a story of curse, is actually a story of blessing. That when we all come together and start building our high and lofty towers is actually to our own destruction, which is why God came down and dispersed the people and confused their language so that they would remain a diverse people to bring about God's love in the world. Yeah.
So what you're saying is we as a church like the people who are like us and we feel more welcome, but then if you're not really thinking my way, I sort of say, oh well, I'm not really joyful.
Right.
And so they lose their voice in my church, so they go someplace else.
Yeah.
And if we really want to be strong and go out in the community, we need to also listen to that.
Yeah. And where I struggle is, I know it's exhausting, right? Because a lot of us come out of our busy weeks and we come to our church on Sunday and we want to rest. We want that charismatic, that preaching. We want some good teaching and just to be filled and then go back out into the world again. I know that we are busy and hungry and tired people. And being open to diversity all the time can be exhausting. I get that. But we've got to figure out how to stay there. Perhaps create some oases along the way where we can kind of, but to not give up diversity for the sake of that. Okay.
I just have a passing thought.
Yeah.
And something you said, you know, like we welcome into their church, into our church. Sometimes I think maybe the best thing is not to have them come into this foreign environment, but rather us go out in their environment and live with them and understand their values and understand how it is that they make decisions.
Amen, sister. Until we begin to finally embrace the truth that we're not going out to them, but we're going out to the missing part of we. Mm-hmm. That perhaps we are the them, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got to rediscover a sense of we. Mm-hmm. So, I think I need to reconnect this. Thank you all for kind of rolling with this today. Okay, so this is truly, I mean, entering the unknown. You have no idea what I'm bringing to you. I can tell you that this is an origin story that's common among many Native peoples in the North American corner of the world. And I just want you to hear, as you think about how stories, our own stories, have shaped who we are and how we function in the world, to think about that. This is about 5.5 minutes long, and then there's another 2-minute piece of her teaching and her struggling to work with her students that I want you to hear kind of in relationship, because it ends up holding alongside her understanding of the creation story and the Christian understanding, Jewish, Judeo-Christian understanding of creation. So,
there was the sun. She fell like a maple seed pirouetting on an autumn breeze. A column of light streamed from a hole in the sky world.
So sky world is falling.
Where only darkness had been before. It took her a long time to fall. In fear, or maybe hope, she clutched a bundle tightly in her hand. Hurtling downward, she saw only dark water below. But in that emptiness, there were many eyes gazing up like a sudden shaft of light. They saw there a small object, a mere dust mote in the beam. And as it grew closer, they could see that it was a woman, her arms outstretched, long black hair billowing behind as she spiraled toward them. The geese nodded at one another and rose together from the water in a wave of goose music, and she felt the beat of their wings as they flew beneath to break her fall. Far from the only home she'd ever known, she caught her breath at the warm embrace of soft feathers as they gently carried her downward. And so it began. The geese could not hold the woman above the water for much longer, so they called a council to decide what to do. Resting on their wings, she saw them all gather. Loons, otters, swans, beavers, fish of all kinds. A great turtle floated in their midst and offered his back for her to rest upon. Gratefully, she stepped from the goose wings onto the dome of his shell. The others understood that she needed land for her home and discussed how they might serve her need. The deep divers among them had heard of mud at the bottom of the water and agreed to go find some. Loon drove first, but the distance was too far, and after a long while, he surfaced with nothing to show for his efforts. One by one, the other animals offered to help. Otter, beaver, sturgeon, but the depth, the darkness, and the pressures were too great for even the strongest of swimmers. They returned, gasping for air, with their heads ringing. Some did not return at all. Soon, only little Muskrat was left, the weakest diver of all. He volunteered to go while the others looked on doubtfully. His small legs flailed as he worked his way downward, and he was gone a very long time. They waited and waited for him to return, fearing the worst for their relative. And before long, a stream of bubbles rose with the limp, small body of the muskrat. He had given his life to aid this helpless human. But then the others noticed that his paw was tightly clenched, and when they opened it, there was a small handful of mud. Turtle said, "Here, put it on my back, and I will hold it." Sky Woman bent and spread the mud with her hands across the shell of the turtle. Moved by the extraordinary gifts of the animals, she sang in thanksgiving and then began to dance, her feet caressing the earth. The land grew and grew as she danced her thanks, from the dab of mud on Turtle's back until the whole earth was made. Not by Sky Woman alone, but from the alchemy of all the animals' gifts, coupled with her deep gratitude. Together they formed what we know today as Turtle Island, our home. Like any good guest, Sky Woman had not come empty-handed. The bundle was still clutched in her hand. When she toppled from the hole in the sky world,
She had reached out to grab onto the tree of life that grew there. In her grasp were branches, fruits and seeds of all kinds of plants. These she scattered onto the new ground and carefully tended each one until the world turned from brown to green. Sunlight streamed through the hole from the sky world, allowing the seeds to flourish. Wild grasses, flowers, trees, medicine spread everywhere. And now that the animals too had plenty to eat, many came to live with her on Turtle Island. Our stories say that of all the plants, weengosh, or sweetgrass, was the very first to grow on Earth, its fragrance a sweet memory of Sky Woman's hand. Accordingly, it is honored as one of the four sacred plants of my people. Breathe in its scent, and you start to remember things you didn't know you had forgotten. Our elders say that ceremonies are the way we remember to remember. And so...
Isn't that lovely?
So you're welcoming new wisdom on your journey. What aspects of wisdom did you hear in her words? And they could just be kind of phrases of thought or...
Sacrifice.
Yeah.
Collaboration.
Gratitude.
Yeah, there was that dance of gratitude, wasn't it? So the next section that I want, and it's just 2 minutes, and this may be kind of the discomfort that I will leave you with. She begins to tell the story, and I'm going to kind of fast through this part just to kind of get to her reflection on it. But as a teacher, working with students' environmental programs and sort of the 101 classes, she sits with them, and she was asking about their relationship between the creative world and kind of humanity, and, you know, what is the nature of that relationship? You know, and here she is with students who are committing, you know, their education and careers towards being in that relationship, you know, and again, it was sort of like, is this a relationship of blessing or curse? And the students were pretty well united in this understanding of, yeah, there's no good between the human relationship of the earth and, you know, between these two things, that basically humans' presence in the world was destructive and harmful. And it just broke her heart. She's like, I mean, if we don't even have a sense of hopefulness, well, you know, like, how do I teach them? How do I move them into a better vision? Mm-hmm. And then it suddenly dawns on her that they were not raised on this story of collaboration and sacrifice and gratitude and relationship, right? And of how the world came into being. That is not a story that they were raised on. And so this is, I've set my glasses down. So this is kind of her, and again, this is about 2 minutes. This is her reflecting on that.
On the earth. As the land becomes impoverished, so too does the scope of their vision. When we talked about this after class, I realized that they could not even imagine what beneficial relationships between their species and others might look like. How can we begin to move forward toward ecological and cultural sustainability if we cannot even imagine what that path feels like? If we can't imagine the generosity of geese? These students, we're not raised on the story of Sky Woman. On one side of the world were people whose relationship with the living world was shaped by Sky Woman, who created a garden for the well-being of all. On the other side was another woman with a garden and a tree. But for tasting its fruit, she was banished from the garden, and the gates clanged shut behind her. That mother of men was made to wander in the wilderness and earn her bread by the sweat of her brow, not by filling her mouth with the sweet, juicy fruits that bend the branches low. In order to eat, she was instructed to subdue the wilderness into which she was cast. Same species, same earth, different stories. Like creation stories everywhere, cosmologies are a source of identity and orientation to the world. They tell us who we are. We are inevitably shaped by them, no matter how distant they may be from our consciousness. One story leads to the generous embrace of the living world, the other to banishment. One woman is our ancestral gardener, a co-creator of the good green world that would be the home of her descendants. The other was an exile, just passing through an alien world on a rough road to her real home in heaven.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right. Is that wisdom we can welcome? Now, I want to jump to defense and say I know in our scriptures we have two creation stories, right? Mm-hmm. There's the first one, the 7 days, and God said, it is good, 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 right? And then it starts over again. And I want to argue with Robin and be like, yeah, but that second story was really, I mean, it's creation, yeah, but it's really more about how sin entered the world and our understanding of sin and how we've mucked up the it is good, it is good, it is good, it is good part, right? But at the same time, if you think of us as a people, and what creation story do we remember? Mm-hmm. It's Adam and the animals and the fig leaves and their nakedness. I mean, we think of that as our story that shapes us and who we are. Mm-hmm. So, blessings on your journey. Thank you all for being here. And tomorrow, my true sense is I keep getting the song in my head. Here I raise my Ebenezer. You know, when something happens, we're going to look at Jacob's story and his need to mark the place where he encountered God and wrestled with God, right? So my hope is oftentimes when we go on a pilgrimage, on a journey, there's something, there's some physical remembrance that we just need to cling to help remind us of all the learnings along the journey. So we're going to be kind of leaning into that so that hopefully we can think about what are the hopeful pieces that we have taken with us this week.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.